Joining me now to question the candidates, CNN Special Assignment Correspondent Ken Bodie, and the President of the League of Women Voters, Dr. Susan Letterman. Susan.
Thank you. Senator Harkin, you propose cutting defense spending by 50% over the next 10 years and using the savings to rebuild America and to reduce the deficit. While many may agree that our military needs have vastly changed and cuts in defense spending are appropriate, how do you explain your proposals to a town like Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which has lost Pease Air Force Base, or to the worker, which will be laid off when a defense production line is closed? What specifically will you do as president to ease their economic hardships?
Well, Susan, thank you for the question. I'd be delighted to answer that. But first, I want to say thank you to the people of New Hampshire who have been so gracious and kind to my wife, Ruth, and me over the last several months. It's meant a great deal to us. But it's also made it pretty tough because as I've walked your state, visited your homes, your workplaces, and your schools, I've felt the pain and the anxiety of new friends who have lost their jobs, lost their homes, had their dreams dashed, families torn apart, young kids who don't have enough money to go to college. This shouldn't happen to such decent, hardworking people, but it is. And because of New Hampshire, I want you to know that I feel an even greater urgency to take our economy back from George Bush,
Senator,
and move it in a new direction.
May I rudely interrupt you, sir?
And that's why I've come out with a specific five-point program, Susan, to do just what you said. Reduce military spending over 10 years by 50%. And what I say to the people at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard is what I've said to them in public. Economic conversion. What George Bush is doing is he's just saying, forget it. Cut the spending and let them go. I say it's time to use these people, some of our best engineers, scientists, systems analysts, computer operators, sheet metal workers, machinists, are working, building things for the Cold War. But the Cold War is over with, and now we have to look ahead. Let's start converting our military-industrial complex to meet the needs of the future. Let's start building commercial ships. Let's start building the next generation of commercial aircraft that we can sell here and around the world. High-speed rail in the Eastern Corridor. New energy technologies for America that are clean and renewable so we don't have to rely on oil from the Mideast or on nuclear power plants. These are the things that we can do to keep these people employed and yet build the infrastructure for the future.
Senator Harkin, one of the reasons that some of your competitors on this stage say they do not accept political action committee contributions is that they believe these are the ways that a political action committee and special interests get a lever and a hold on politicians and public policy. When you began this campaign, you said you were proud of all the political action committee money you received from organized labor. Could you tell us where specifically you disagree with the legislative programs and goals of organized labor in America today?
Well, as I've said about political action money, you know, I find it incongruous that some would say you shouldn't take PAC money, but they'll take $1,000 contributions from corporate CEOs. You know, what? I don't understand the difference between that.
Senator, we settle that some will take it and some will not. But tell us on organized labor specifically, where you do take a lot of money, where you disagree, and where you, as president, would disagree with organized labor.
Well, first of all, I have been strong in support of raising the CAFE standards, the corporate average fuel economy of our automobiles, something that labor disagrees with me on that issue. I have been, again, as I said, for stopping the B-2 bomber, and quite frankly, labor's not too excited about that one either. So those are just two primary examples of where I've taken a course of action different than what organized labor called for.
Senator Harkin, you've been very vocal on the need for the United States to get tough with protectionist countries that and threaten to do their ability to do business in the United States, indeed, if they don't change their policies. Don't you expect them to retaliate if you do that? And what would you do about that sort of retaliation? Wouldn't that just start raising trade barriers all around the world?
Susan, we've got to get tough on trade. I saw a Japanese individual on television said the reason they sold so many cars here is because Americans want to buy them. I said, fair enough. I had my staff check the price of sirloin steak in downtown Tokyo, $26 a pound. We can get it there for less than $5 a pound. Why don't we? Doors are closed. In the next 10 years, the Japanese are going to go on a massive home building, house building program. They'll buy our logs, but they won't buy our finished lumber, our finished wood products like plywood and boards. Why not? Doors closed. I'm saying trade has to be a two-way street, not a one-way bridge. Second thing I'm going to do is shut the revolving door. Of the top 19 trade negotiators under Reagan and Bush, 9 went to work for foreign governments, 7 went to work for Japan. As president, I'm going to hire the best negotiators, and I'm going to make them sign a document, a legally enforceable document, that says that when they get through negotiating for the United States, they won't be able to trade for a foreign company or a foreign country for at least 10 years. That's what we've got to do.
Senator Harkin, let's talk about welfare for a second.
As you ask the question, we have less than 30 seconds left for Senator Harkin's segment.
Can I ask the question?
Yes, it depends on the senator's brevity.
Governor Cuomo said that able-bodied people without child care responsibility should be required to work for their welfare check. What's wrong with that concept of an able-bodied person going to work to work on public works projects like infrastructure or cleaning up the environment or helping with senior citizens? What's wrong with the concept?
When I was a young man, my father told me that the best social program was a job. And I still believe that, and that's why my economic program will put people back to work in this country, not on make-work jobs
Can you tell me what's wrong with Governor Clinton's concept of having able-bodied people who are on welfare work in public works projects?
Because it approaches it from the wrong end. It approaches it from the end of saying we're going to have people on welfare, so therefore let's put them to work on dead-end jobs. I approach it from a different standpoint.
I'm sure we're going to come back.
We can put people to work on good jobs so they don't have to go on welfare.
Let's go now to Susan.
Okay. Governor Clinton, your environmental record has gotten mixed reviews. If you're elected president, what would you do if you were pressured by industry to relax environmental standards to create, a significant number of jobs for Americans or to make our industry here more competitive with industry abroad?
I would oppose that. I believe if you have uniform national environmental standards, it's good for the economy, not bad for the economy. Every evidence is that if we hold firm with the Clean Air Act, if we accelerate our efforts to reduce CO2 emissions by raising fuel efficiency standards, if we do things like accelerate the reduction of solid waste and the recycling of solid waste, we will generate tens of thousands of high technology jobs, jobs that former defense workers might do, jobs that former scientists and engineers in the defense industry might help to create. I can see that even here in New Hampshire, where I visited a small company building a machine that reduces CFC emissions into the air to try to reduce ozone depletion. I asked the people who were running it, just a small business, I said, what is the national demand for this product? They said, could be up to 1 million. So I think we have to make one of the big decisions in this election, which is that good environmental policy can be good for the economy, not bad for the economy, if you have uniform national standards.
Governor Clinton, you all on this stage have some plan or another for health care to reach the 33 million Americans who don't presently have it. I want to ask you about the cost, because in the short run, if we add those people to effective health care, there's going to be quite a demand on the system. They're going to drive up total costs of health care, and I want to know what you do to control those costs. Would you, for example, be prepared to ration certain expensive health care measures and procedures, diagnostic procedures like CAT scans, medical procedures like heart bypasses, or would you be willing to consider rationing the amount of money that doctors can actually get from federally sponsored and financed health care programs?
Well, let me say, I think that question is backwards because we are rationing health care today. All the people without access to health care, people who live in inner cities and rural areas, people who don't have long-term care, people who don't have any kind of health care coverage, their health care is rationed. Then they get it when they're too sick, it's too late, and it's too expensive. Let me tell you how I would begin. I think we should begin with mandatory national insurance reform. Cut out the incredible waste in the present system of insurance finance, somewhere between $35 and $50 billion a year. Simplify the billing procedures to reduce fraud and to reduce bureaucratic growth by having a basic uniform policy that has to be provided by both public and private sources for all Americans. And then reduce dramatically the amount of micromanagement of the healthcare system by the federal government by putting people into healthcare groups. Now, two different healthcare groups have analyzed this proposal that I've made and have concluded that it will save between $80 and $120 billion a year. With that savings, you can cover everybody and provide long-term care. Will some people pay more? You betcha. The people that aren't paying anything now will have to pay something. But over the long run, within 3 to 4 years, we'll all be paying less than the society would have been paying otherwise.
Let's turn to education. You propose setting national standards for math and science. How will requiring national standards and tests correct what's wrong, what's not working in our schools? And indeed, if you even figure out what's not working in our schools, where will you get the money to fund change?
First of all, not all of what's wrong with our schools requires more money. And I think I've raised more money for education than anybody running for president this year, at least proportionally. But the reason we need national standards that basically measure our international levels of learning is that all of our children will live in a world in which what they earn depends on what they can learn, a world in which they will find constant change, in which they'll have to change their work 7 or 8 times in a lifetime. When our young people get out of high school today, they're 1 or 2 years behind our major competitors in learning. One of the things we need to do is to make sure at least that we have uniform standards of measurement. That's what national standards are about. And meaningful exams annually updated that measure that. Then you give the information back to every school district, to every school, to every parent, to every teacher in this country. And you encourage a whole new era of innovation and change and restructuring of our schools, measuring the results. We don't know how to keep score now. Most of the standardized tests don't amount to a hill of beans, and there is no sense of national standards. Only the National Council of Math Teachers have come up with some real standards that mean something. So we need that very much.
Governor, in this campaign, you've made tax relief for the middle class a major theme of yours. But your critics say back in Arkansas, you've relied almost entirely on a regressive sales tax system for financing the programs that you've put forward. Will you change your views on taxation as president?
Well, I think it's fair to say that virtually every governor in the country has presided over a sales tax increase in the 1980s, either to pay the bills, which we never did, or to increase investment in education and economic development. All the money we raised through the sales tax was put in trust funds to educate the middle class and the poor and to increase the economic capacity of our state. It also, as a practical matter, constitutionally was the only tax we could raise. I also reduced income taxes for 42% of the people in our state. What has happened in the 1980s is that middle class incomes have gone down. Middle class tax burden at the federal, state, and local level has gone up. I want to make a down payment on fairness and also to increase the capacity of middle class people to consume.
Governor,
I think it is an important beginning.
Susan will now take us to Senator Kerry.
Senator Kerry, under your U.S. health proposal, the Congress and the President would set total amount to be spent on health care while the states would manage how this care is provided. What would you do as president to ensure that the people of New Hampshire get as good health care as any other state? And to ensure, too, that rationing or whatever would be needed would be fair and equitable and take care of the health problems of the people?
Well, I'm going to try to explain it, Susan, so the person sitting out there in the audience who's trying to figure out whether or not payroll taxes versus premiums are going to be better. I mean, essentially what I say is that eligibility under my proposal occurs in a radically different fashion. Instead of occurring as a consequence of where you work, it occurs as a consequence of being an American under color of law. It's a simplified eligibility. Your payments, instead of making premium payments, you'll pay through a taxpayer system. Most people will pay less. It's 1% on a payroll for employees, 4% for employers. The way that you ensure that health care is going to be available for the people of New Hampshire is you vest in the people themselves the power to make decisions about where they go, what kind of care they're going to get, which doctor do they go to, which hospital. Allows them to establish community-based clinics. The power vests in the people to make those decisions. Instead of having all the President and the Congress will do is establish uniform benefits for the nation. Have a budgeted amount once it's priced out, and then have a big debate about exactly how to collect the revenue. Then they'll redistribute and bust up the federal bureaucracy and have the states actually making the payments.
Senator Kerry, you've said that the Cold War is over and Germany, Taiwan, and Japan won it. You've also said up here in New Hampshire that you'd get tough with Japan, that if we can't sell in their markets, they can't sell in our markets, that you would force them to open their markets. Exactly what would you do to force Japan to open their markets as president?
Well, I'd use the Trade Act of 88. I mean, it's called Super 301 and 301. I'd essentially say that we're going to put tariffs on your products coming in the United States unless you give us open and free access to your markets. I'm afraid it was actually Paul Tsongas who said that the Cold War is over and Japan and Germany won. I wish I'd thought of that line. It's a great line. I mean, what I see in the world today, now that the Cold War is over, Ken, is the opportunity really to put together new trading structures for the world. I outlined in a speech a couple weeks ago in Boston my view that I would, as president, lead Japan and the Pacific Rim nations and the Europeans to form new trading structures so that we can expand trade into the rest of the world, trying to convert, in a very exciting way, old enemies into new customers. I see trade as a powerful means where we can lift our standard of living, improve the value of our environment, and strengthen our communities. Under Republicans, it simply meant that jobs are going to leave the United States.
Senator, in contrast to most other Democratic candidates, your education proposals center on school-by-school innovation, not national standards. Won't that continue and encourage the gap between wealthy and poor districts? How are you going to solve that problem?
Well, I actually think just the opposite, although I must say with respect that I do support national standards. I like the idea of a national standard. I'm just very nervous about a national test. What my Educational Capital Corporation allows is the federal government to cut out the bureaucracy and go directly to the community level and bring resources in a very rapid and, I think, exciting fashion to support community-based reform, to attempt to equalize the savage inequalities that exist at the local level today and essentially support parents and community leaders and their community-based effort to make our schools better.
Senator Kerry, you said that the next president will have to make tough choices and not be afraid to risk political capital. I hope it was you who said that. Entitlement programs and the deficit may fall into that category. Can you point specifically to any entitlement programs that, or special interest subsidies in the federal budget that you might be willing to cut out in order to help manage the deficit?
Yes, I mean, I've supported eliminating the disaster program in agriculture and replace it with crop insurance. I've supported, with my national health insurance proposal, bringing Medicaid and Medicare into a single system and actually ends up abolishing Medicaid and requires us to pay as you go. We'll have $35 billion worth of bond sales this year to pay doctor and hospital bills. And under my proposal, we have a responsibility to pay as you go.
Senator, you and Governor Clinton both support a small tax cut for the middle class taxpayers, and that will be paid for by tax for wealthier Americans. Mm-hmm. I'm told that that's going to average about $30 per family per month. Is this enough to get our economy moving? Isn't there a better way to spend that money to get our economy up to speed?
Look, it may not make much difference for you and I, but for somebody out there making $15,000 a year who got the shaft in the 1980s because their taxes went up at the local level of property tax, their payroll taxes have gone up, the progressivity has been ripped out of our tax system. No, I think it's time to raise taxes on wealthy Americans and lower them on middle class people so that they can buy the things that they need. I don't actually argue it from the standpoint that I believe they're going to get massive stimulation in the economy, but I believe very strongly that it'll restore equity, and I believe that money means something.
And now we go to Senator Tsongas.
Senator, in hard times, people's fears of losing their jobs and general economic uncertainty are often exploited by politicians, pitting one group against another. One example, of course, is David Duke's campaign, which criticizes affirmative action, welfare, and plays upon these economic and racial fears, indeed dividing Americans. What will you do in your campaign and as president to counter racism and heal the wounds of hatred that continue to tear our nation apart?
Thank you. Let me, if I may, just correct Ken from an earlier statement. The Cold War is over. Japan won was David Halberstam's quote. I do not wish to take credit for something I did not originate. George Bush began the division. When he used Willie Horton, that was the precursor for David Duke. So I think the politics of dividing the country so you can rule it has gone back in this administration. What I've tried to do in this campaign is to explain two things. One, if you expand the economic pie, you have, by definition, opportunity. So people are not competing against each other. But if you have a shrinking economic pie, it is, by definition, an illiberal society. And that's where David Duke comes from. The second thing I've tried to do in the campaign is to describe that we are part of a team. When we compete with Japan and Germany, you have the German team, the Japanese team, the American team. And whether we like it or not, we are all linked to each other. So we all have a self-interest in each other doing well. So when you look across at someone who's different from you, not to see them as a competitor, but to see that person as part of your team. So you have a self-interest in that person doing well. This nation must be healed. I think it's very clear that these candidates, that we are committed to that healing process. But I think it must be stated clearly, when George Bush used the Willie Horton ad, he went down a road. That road was purposeful and not healthy for this country.
Senator Tsongas, you have a higher level of support for nuclear energy than any of your competitors on this stage. All around the country, there are nuclear plants. Some are online, some are waiting and ready to go online. As president, in your energy policy, as you develop that policy, how high a priority will nuclear energy have?
My energy policy is very clear. Maximize conservation, and I've been doing that, Ken, for a long time. Maximize renewables. The first solar cell amendment ever to pass the Congress was mine, back in the 70s. And I also added $1 billion in the authorization for conservation in renewables. And you have to get the utilities to do most of that work. So conservation, renewables. Then you maximize the use of natural gas. Natural gas is the environmentalist fuel of choice. And then you basically pick your poison. You've got oil. We talked earlier about the Persian Gulf and the trade imbalance that oil, foreign oil, gives to us. Nuclear, that has its safety problems and its waste problems, and coal, which has the carbon dioxide problems. I happen to feel that global warming is the most serious environmental threat to this country. So for me, nuclear is part of the last tier, but it will be part of the process until we get into a position where renewables and long-term fusion fill the bill.
Yes. Some economists claim that this recession is different than our past recessions. And indeed, this involves a major restructuring of our economy. Those who've lost their jobs are not likely to return to the same industry, certainly not to the same job. What role do you foresee for the federal government in managing such massive economic change? Should the government simply protect the existing industries like steel and auto or do something else?
Well, let's look at Japan. What Japan does, they recognize that certain industries mature. So they put their efforts into building new companies. So they are into things like venture capital, equity capital, research and development, basic science. The role of the federal government is to say to the business community, we will give you the tools to compete. Here is the capital, here's the trained workforce, here are the regulations that allow you to think long term. That's the direction we have to go in. I don't think our job, by the way, is to pick winners and losers. We cannot do that. Our job is to give them the ground that they can grow in and provide them the raw material.
Senator Tsongas, in the short run, are you prepared to take any tough action to improve America's position vis-a-vis trade policy in Japan?
I think you go to Japan once you have put in place an aggressive U.S. economic battle plan. The problem George Bush had when he was over in Japan, they looked across at the Americans without respect. We were going there asking for concessions rather than going to them and saying, this is what we have to do. But if they don't do it, very clear you have to impose restrictions. But let me tell you, the strongest would be to go to the American people and say the Japanese have not been fair. They are restrictive in their policies, and I call upon you to understand that in your consumer purchases.
So in other words, you'd call upon Americans not to buy Japanese cars.
If the Japanese are not willing to be reasonable, then you have to play hardball.
And now we go to Jerry Brown.
In contrast to your colleagues, Governor Brown, who proposed middle-class tax cuts, capital gains reductions, or some combination of these, you suggest replacing the progressive income tax with a flat tax of 13% for everyone, regardless of how much money they make. Why should a family earning $25,000 a year pay the same as an individual who perhaps is earning $200,000 a year? Is that fair?
As a matter of fact, they pay a lot more, proportionally, because they pay the regressive payroll tax. And the whole idea of the 13% flat tax is fairness. Strip away what Jimmy Carter called this disgrace to the human race, the tax code. Rich people have lawyers, they have lobbyists, they get the loopholes, they get the tax-exempt bonds. What I'm proposing is a 13% tax in lieu of the 15.3% Social Security payroll tax, the 28% income tax, and all the other taxes that people pay. This will be a major incentive because business will be able to expense new equipment 100% the first year. People on Social Security will be able to earn as much as they want without losing their Social Security benefits. And what is most important, we won't have to have all these changes every year. George Bush now wants to lower the capital gains tax. In 1986, he supported President Reagan's increase. In 1981, the investment tax credit was expanded. In 1986, it was eliminated. And now Republicans and Democrats alike want to bring it back. That kind of churning of the tax code is a good source of the corrupt campaign fundraising. It is a major weight on the economy, where 3 million man hours a year are spent trying to figure out what the tax laws mean. I'm for reform, simplicity, and fairness, and I believe this will give the biggest shot in the arm to our economy and create millions of jobs instead of these, what I would call, rather marginal changes.
Governor Brown, a major thrust of your campaign has been to eliminate special interest money from American politics. I want you to tell us, in the way of programs, what has this money bought? and what would you be prepared to eliminate? Where is the special interest pork barrel that you think you could eliminate as president?
Well, let's start with the whole lack of a national health care system. The medical packs...
Well, that's something we don't have. What do we have? What has that money bought in the way of America?
Well, it's bought quite a lot. We're spending $800 billion a year for medical care, more than any other country in the world. And the medical lobbies and their insurance allies have given the Congress $60 million in the last 10 years. The used car dealers were able to fight back a change that the Federal Trade Commission wanted by $500,000 in contributions. So too were the funeral makers. Look at the tax code, all the loopholes, the ripoffs, the whole sort of what's going on in that Congress. They're spending half their time raising money, and the impact is we have millions of people out of work, our economy is deteriorating, and we don't have that commitment to what I believe is the most important thing of all, and that is a family bill of rights that would guarantee a living wage to every American, education, health care, food and shelter, and to be free from insecurity in their old age. I want to see that as the cornerstone, and the only way that's going to happen is if we reform our politics.
Governor Brown, let's talk a little more about that health care system reform that you propose. You propose that we model it after the Canadian system. How would you, again, guarantee that your system would not produce long lines, lengthy waits for surgery, lower quality care, perhaps denial of some care that people might feel they need?
Because under this plan, we have an overall budget that the United States would adopt. It would be democratically determined. This is not going to be the private corporate management of medicine that Paul Tsonga supports. It won't be the pay-or-play that will create a two-tier or a three-tier system. This is a system where we're all in it, we all have a stake in it. And just as in Canada, where you have a single payer, people are living 2 years longer, the infant mortality rate is half of what it is here. So I have great confidence that our representatives will be able to fashion both a limit on the spending and the proper basic care that will take care of the American people.
Governor Brown, senior citizens are amongst the most active and powerful of all of our special interest groups in this country. Would you take them on and means test Social Security?
Well, I'll tell you this. I would say for certain high-income earners, they ought to pay their taxes. For the vast majority of Social Security recipients, that is their nest egg. That's their basic income. But where you have very wealthy people, I would tax their Medicare and their total income, whatever it is.
But you would not means test Social Security payments overall?
Well, means test sounds like it's going to be turned into a welfare program. And I think the genius of Social Security is that everybody's in it and everyone supports it.
Our thanks to Susan Letterman and to Ken Bodie. Now, on to the second part of this debate. The structure of this segment is more open, less formal, gentlemen. It's designed to foster discussion among the candidates to encourage a freewheeling exchange. My involvement as moderator will be kept to a minimum as much as possible. The extent of a candidate's participation in this segment will largely be a function of his own assertiveness. However, this debate's producers and I will be monitoring these proceedings to ensure that each of you gets approximately the same amount of time to make his points. And now, gentlemen, given these times of unpredictability, and given these times of self-doubt, what qualities should this nation's leader have?
Well, the qualities, I believe, are very simple. We have two choices here,
Governor Jerry Brown,
if I can put it in this framework. I think you have, on the one hand, the politics of the past, represented by incumbent office holders, and you have the politics of the future. Mr. Tsongas, I believe, represents a more conservative, business-oriented view of the future. I represent what I would call a reform view, anti-nuclear, worker participation and ownership, a flat tax proposal instead of the business taxes he proposes. But I think people have a real choice here to send a message to the country that two people outside the system are coming back as a real critique of this system. And if New Hampshire wants to send a very powerful message that they want real change, I would say pick Mr. Tsongas if you want the more conservative business version, or if you want a more populist reform version of the same future politics, I'd say vote for me.
I disagree. I believe that what the people need in a president
is
someone
Governor
who
Clinton.
Has the vision to tell people where we are and where we ought to go, to strip away the denial of the last 10 years, and to put out a program that is both specific and compelling and powerful, but also who has the ability to actually change things. The reason I decided to run for president is I spent more than a decade of my life working for change. You can be a change agent within the system. You can make jobs. You can educate people. You can solve social problems. You can get people to ratify over and over and over again, as I have through five elections, a commitment to change and improvement. That's what America needs. All these plans may be good, but in the end, somebody has to lead and galvanize and energize and challenge this country. And I think that's what we need in the president.
Well, I also disagree. I mean, it's not, this campaign is not about a choice between people that are in office with respect and people who are out of office.
Senator
this
Kerry.
Campaign is about trying to decide if America is going to move in a new direction. Our president has got his head outside the Cold War, but his entire body is still in it. Our government needs to be shaken up. We are fighting the Cold War still, and there is an urgent necessity. If we want to create high-paying jobs, we've got to shake that government up and change what it is doing to bring it in line with our international competition, and we're not doing that. I believe what we need is in a president is somebody who's willing to come and tell the American people the truth. Come and tell the American people that we've got a real challenge on our hands. If we're going to increase our wages and increase our opportunity and increase our standard of living, we're going to have to save more and invest more. We're also going to have the courage to fight right now for national health insurance, not a proposal, a promise to do it sometime later. It is time to fulfill the promise of Social Security by bringing national health insurance to every single American as a right. It is an exciting time to do it. That's not the end, but the beginning of the kinds of changes that I think Americans are ready to fight for right now.
First of all, Bernie, we Democrats have to have a nominee. And that means we have to have someone who is tough enough to take on Bush and whip him. Someone whose armor is thick enough to withstand the assaults of the Reagan propaganda machine that's going to come after us this year.
Senator,
I've got
Harkin.
A record of beating Republicans for a long time. I've got organizations in 25 states, half the states of this union, ready to go. I've slated more delegates in Illinois than ever in the history of this country. As soon as we finish here in New Hampshire, that national campaign is ready to go on my behalf. Secondly, I believe we have to provide a contrast. I don't believe it's enough for us Democrats to go to the American people and say, well, here's Bush, and then we have a little bit of something like that. We'll be a little bit for capital gains. We'll support a little bit of export of jobs overseas, but it'll be just fine-tuning it. I think we have to provide a contrast. We have to give the American people a choice, a clean break with Reagan, Bush, trickle-down economics. Throw it out the window. Get rid of it. Have a new democratic economic program that uses the power of this government to get our people back to work on good jobs, rebuilding a new America.
Well, let's hear from Jerry Brown. Let's hear from Jerry Brown's alleged fellow outsider.
I appreciate the endorsement.
I said politics of the future.
Thank you.
And maybe that has to come from the outside.
Let me say that we are all here presuming to replace George Bush. So we have to think of it in terms of what do we offer that he doesn't. And I think what it comes down to, if you look at what George Bush has done, his core is very narrow. What principles is he willing to sacrifice for something else? Almost all of them. Talk about choice. Women have a right to choice in this country. He has gone from Planned Parenthood to anti-choice for his own political benefit. In terms of, for example, the environment. He said he was the environmental president, and then he tried to abolish wetlands. He talked about civil rights and that kind of thing. Then the Willie Horton Act. What we have to offer to the American people is a core of principle. There are some things so sacred, you simply did not abandon them. And I think we do that. And let me give you an example. There are two ways to run a campaign. One way is to think November, November, November. What can I do to appeal? George Bush's State of the Union message was Santa Claus. The other way of doing this is to think January 20th. What is the vision so I can govern? So you take positions, not calculated, to do things that are good politically, but it will allow you to have a mandate. So when you take office on January 20th, you can turn this country around. And I have disagreements with my colleagues on some of these issues, but I will tell you, each of these people has a stronger core than the man that we are running against.
You were about to take issue with
Senator
from the
Saunders.
Insiders and the outsiders. Last go around, and then my next question will not strain your imagination at all, gentlemen.
Well, I do not think it's a question of insider or outsider. I mean, I think you've got to demonstrate that you've got the courage to face the American people and tell them the truth. And the fact of the matter is, that's exactly what I've attempted to do in this campaign, on the deficit, not giving the American people just the good news, but telling them that we've got to reduce that deficit. It's an obligation to our children that we do that. Telling them that we've got an obligation, as 4% of the world's population, consuming 25% of the world's energy, we've got an obligation to reduce that consumption, not just for economic reasons, but to make sure that we've just fought our last war for cheap oil.
Governor, before I move on,
the only thing I was going to say, Bernie, is I think what would be helpful in organizing this, so, you know, all these people are watching us tonight and they're trying to say, they must be thinking, oh, these guys sound pretty good to me. And I was thinking that just listening to the others talk. I think it would be helpful if we could all say, what do we think of the two or three really big defining issues of this election? I mean, I believe, and I think we all do, no matter who wins this election, even, God forbid, if it's President Bush, this election will shape a generation of life for Americans. And it seems to me that the voters are going to have to say, what are the big issues? Do you believe we have to have a dramatic change and have a national economic strategy? Do you believe we have to scrap this old cut a quick buck, forget about your neighbor, get it while you can philosophy, and have a sense of common purpose and long term? And this is the argument maybe between us. Do you believe, it's not outsider, insider, do you believe you have to have a radically different kind of federal government? Yes, I think we have to have a more activist government, but it also has to be more community-based, less bureaucratic, and provide more citizen choice. I mean, it seems to me those are the issues that would help the voters to figure out which way we ought to go in this election.
Okay, before we move on, I don't want anyone to leave this hall tonight feeling slighted. So, Senator Harkin, briefly.
Well, again, as I say, Reagan and Bush economics trickle-down is premised on two things. We take your money, tax dollars from our people, and we give it to the wealthy, the few wealthy at the top, and then we trust them to do what's right. Secondly, we take your tax dollars and we put it into a military-industrial complex to fight the Soviet Union and win the Cold War. Well, look what happened when we did the first. We got leveraged buyouts, junk bond dealers, $1 trillion in trade deficit, 50,000 people in New Hampshire lost their jobs, 1.2 million manufacturing jobs lost just since Bush became president. So we know the first doesn't work, and the second is no longer applicable. Now, I disagree a little bit with David Halberstam or Mr. Tsongas. I believe we did win the Cold War. Freedom and democracy won. Now we have a window of opportunity. Will we throw out the old? Will we have a new economic program that focuses on putting our people back to work, building the infrastructure of this country so the private sector can be more productive and efficient, focus on educating every young person in America to the maximum possible extent? That's what we have to do in the future.
Bernard, this question, gentlemen.
Address that issue as well. I'm an outsider, but I think it's presumptuous to suggest that having been outside gives anybody an advantage. Because when you raise your hand, you're sworn in, you are the ultimate insider. So the issue is, what do you stand for? If I could just indulge for a moment, what I'm trying to get across to the people of New Hampshire and the people of this country is that the only economic strategy that can work is to understand how you grow your economy. Where is the engine of the economy? That engine is manufacturing. So my economic policies go to that engine, to drive that engine to be profitable and be competitive. Being an outsider doesn't make that happen. Neither does being an insider make it happen. The ultimate issue, when you raise your hand, you become the insider. What are you going to do to provide jobs for the people of this country?
Please, gentlemen, respond directly and succinctly to this question. It's now 1993. You're in the Oval Office. You are President of the United States. Money is very, very tight, but two funding requests are on your desk. One, Russian President Boris Yeltsin wants $10 billion to jumpstart his republic's economy. Two, your Labor Department says $10 billion is the price tag for your program to retrain unemployed blue and white collar workers, American workers. What, as president, would you do? Senator Kerry, you're smiling.
I'll put $10 billion on American workers. That's an easy answer. I mean, I by the way, have argued that as president of the United States, I intend to lead the industrial coalition, the Japan, the Pacific Rim nations, and Europeans to try to assist the Soviet Union in making this transition. But we don't have the resources to, on our own, put a Marshall Plan in place in the Soviet Union. We have an obligation, in my judgment, to work with the Soviet Union, the Commonwealth of Independent States, to assist in this transition because, as I said earlier, there is an opportunity for us to work to convert old enemies into new customers. But in order to do that, we've got to have product here. And I believe, by the way, in picking winners. I want to, after the Cold War is over, go on right now and win steel, consumer electronics, semiconductors, machine tools, automobiles, and aerospace. I want to identify those industries that are crucial for our economy, and unless we put our money in training, we're not going to get the job done.
Let's hear from you other presidents.
Well, look, the real question is, where is the $10 billion going? I mean, the fact
Governor Jerry Brown.
An economy of $6
trillion. Well, the choice was either $10 billion to Boris Yeltsin, our friend in Russia, or to retrain blue and white collar Americans.
It's not an either or here. We just spent $100 billion to bail out the savings and loans. They found that. The politicians found $40,000 a year to increase their salary. There's money. The real question is, could something profitably be done to help the Soviet peoples and the Russian people and all those new republics become active members of the world trading community? If they begin to buy and sell to us, we will then be able to expand our own economy and put those many millions of Americans who aren't working to work. Trade is the thing that will create the jobs. That's why I support an expanded port system, American shipping, and American rail. I don't know whether $10 billion makes any sense or not, but if I could figure out a way with a relatively small amount of money to start seeding the Russian economy so it became a big purchaser of American-made products, I'd do it in a minute.
Gentlemen?
I think the other way that you could answer that is to say very clearly that unless you have retrained American workers, you will not have a strong American economy, and you cannot be generous not only to the Soviets and to the Russians, but to other countries as well. So the theory is you take this country, make it vibrant, make it strong, make it competitive, and then you'll be in a position to reach out. And I will also say, I think Bob Kerry is correct, that the Japanese and the Germans have to ante up here. They have massive trade surpluses, and they have the resources to reach out to a Boris Yeltsin. I think it's about time they did that.
In a heartbeat, I'd spend the money on American workers. Let me tell you how I'd spend it. First, I would institute a national apprenticeship system to train people coming out of high school who don't want to go to college but don't want to be in dead-end jobs. Second, I would have a national program to work with states to teach everybody in America with a job to read within 5 years and give every one of those workers a chance to get a high school diploma. Third, I would institute a national annual system for providing some retraining to all frontline workers. And finally, I would set up a national service trust out of which any American could borrow the money to go to college and pay it back, either as a small percentage of their income or with a couple of years of work here at home. Then here's what I'd do about the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. I would do exactly what they say. I'd say, we don't have $10 billion. We're going to spend $1 billion or so to help you dismantle your nuclear weapons. We'll help you get food and medicine to get through the winter with our allies in Europe and Japan. And then we'll ask them to work with us to help convert your currency. Finally, let me just make this one point. I don't think that we can do them a lot of good with a whole lot of money until they figure out how to transform their economy to a market economy. We can help them convert their currency and
Bernie, sometimes a simple question requires a simple answer. Invest the money here, educate our people, retrain our workers.
Senator Kerry.
Well, let me just do a follow on that. I'm in danger of stealing some of my own time later. There's a terrific speech given the other day by one of President Bush's guys. He said, we want to help you find new projects that will allow you to remain in your country and earn a decent living, applying your skills to the cause of science and peace rather than forging weapons of war. It's a speech given to nuclear scientists who are now trying to figure out what they're going to do with their lives now that the demand for nuclear weapons is sharp to the right. That speech was given by Secretary Baker. But it wasn't given to American workers who are terrified now that the Cold War is over about what's going to happen to their jobs. It was given to Soviet scientists in Chelyabinsk in Western Siberia. I think it's terrific that the United States is making the effort to denuclearize the Soviet Union. But the speech that Secretary Baker gave to Soviet scientists, I'm going to give to American workers.
Next question.
Corey, I want to say one thing on it.
Can you make it brief, please?
I'll make it very simply. The idea that there's only $10 billion in our $6 trillion economy to provide training to get jobs is just not true. This country and this economy is being held back by the stagnation in our nation's government, our nation's capital. We're spending, as a people, $300 billion a year for energy consumption we don't even need. And right there, every American unemployed could be put to work if our president would embark upon a plan of eliminating that huge and obscene energy waste. Just doing that would put people to work, and we could pay for it out of the savings that would be generated. And it would be a 15-year jobs program that would actually save money, not cost.
Bernard, if I could intrude on my own time as well. Back in the fall, I called upon the president to set up an executive Peace Corps to take people from the United States who have skills in management and other kinds of management skills and ask them to give a year or two of their lives to the republics, the former Soviet republics. That is how we can help them. What they need is talent. They need expertise, that kind of thing. And that does not cost money. And I will tell you, there would be thousands of Americans who would jump at the chance to reach out to those people and help them. And there was talk about that in the fall, then they dropped it. So I'd like to use this opportunity, if I could, to call upon the president to institute that policy today. Let's get it going.
To each of you would-be presidents, what percentage of the gross national product would you reserve for environmental cleanup? And what single issue would you emphasize first?
If I could.
The floor is yours, sir.
Twice in a row, I feel rather presumptuous, but let me do it. The two great issues for the environment, not only of this country, but this world, world population, which George Bush has backed away from, as Ronald Reagan did, and global warming. Those are the two issues that threaten the viability, not only of this country, but of this planet. I would be extremely aggressive as President of the United States to go to the world organizations and implement and fund family planning. You know, I lived in Ethiopia for 2 years, and what's happening in these countries, their populations are exploding, people are leaving the countryside because it cannot be sustained there, they're flooded into the cities, and those cities are uninhabitable. The second is global warming. I chaired the first hearings on global warming in the Congress, and that was back a long time ago, very few people came. Now people understand the seriousness of this issue, and I think that, of all the issues we talk about, is the most serious threat, not only to a Florida or to a Cape Cod or to the San Francisco Bay Area, but to all of us.
Let me say that in the 80s, one of the most bizarre aspects of the federal budget is that while we triple the debt, we actually reduced our investment on the things that make us richer: education, research and development, environmental technology, infrastructure, economic development. What percentage? Let me just tell you what I would do. I would take every dollar we're spending on defense research and development that we reduce and put it into commercial research and development. I would target environmental cleanup and new environmental technologies as a way of putting scientists and engineers and former defense workers to work in cleaning up America. And there's a lot of environmental cleanup that needs to be done here. And then one final point. I would work very, very hard on reducing global warming, just as Paula said, partly through a new energy policy here at home. Natural gas, energy conservation, renewable resources. And finally, I would institute an international effort through the UN to try to reduce rainforest destruction, which I happen to think presents a terrible threat to all of us in the years ahead.
Ernie, first of all, I would take the lead in the world community in reducing CO2 emissions by the year 2000, and keeping them at least at the present level, reducing them by maybe 20% by the year 2005. I think President Bush is missing a golden opportunity at the Rio conference this June by not taking that leadership position. Secondly, as president, I would institute programs of what we call feebates. I would insist that people who package things, for example, in non-recyclable packages would have to pay a fee. Those that put them in recyclable packages would get that fee. So it would be no net cost to the taxpayer, but you'd reward people for using recyclable products. Third, I would embark on a program of energy efficiency, first of all, by raising the fuel efficiency standards of automobiles. And I would do that immediately. We can do it, and we got to push Detroit on that. Secondly, we have to use more conservation of energy in this country. And you're going to hear me talk a lot about a man by the name of Wes Birdsall in this campaign of Osage, Iowa, a town of 3,500. Back in the late 70s, that town, that municipal utility, in order to meet its electric demand, was going to buy a new generator. It cost him $1 million. Well, they didn't have $1 million. So Wes went out and put in conservation measures in Osage, Iowa, a town of about 3,500 people. In that intervening time, they've spent about $250,000, not a million. No one's had to turn their thermostats down. They live quite well. They've had 5 electric rate reductions. Their kilowatt per hour price is now about 5 cents a kilowatt. Think what that costs you here in New Hampshire. And they've got new business to locate in the community because the business gets cheaper electric rates. So it provides jobs. Energy conservation provides more jobs. I would use natural gas as a bridge to the future. We got more natural gas than we know what to do with in this country, and it burns cleaner than oil. And lastly, I would embark on a program of developing solar hydrogen for the future. That's 20 to 25 years down the pike. But that, I believe, will keep us from going to the nuclear option that Paul Tsongas wants to move to. I don't believe we need that nuclear option. I believe if we put that in those programs I just mentioned, we can have a clean environment, we can put more people to work, we can save money, and we can have a clean environment.
Bernie, let me, do you want to jump in, Jerry?
Go ahead. No, you go.
Gosh, I hate to interrupt you. You know how sensitive I am. Well, let me first of all, say that there is an urgent need to get a climate treaty on global warming. I mean, the President of the United States has been dilly-dallying around, taking the advice of John Sununu, who may be the only American who doesn't think global warming is a real threat. Secondly, I do believe population control is a very important international issue, and I would try to lead the international community away from the Bush policy, which essentially says that economic development and the rhythm method are the best ways to control population. Thirdly, we have an urgent need here at home. On the environment. I mean, and it illustrates the real challenge in this country. I mean, the biggest polluters in the United States of America are the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy. We have to completely restructure this Cold War structure that we've got in place and shift it over not only into civilian economies, supporting those technologies of energy efficiency in automobiles and building materials and home appliances that will create American jobs, but to do it in a fashion that allows us to bring resources to local communities like Pease Air Force Base, where there are Superfund sites. They need those cleanups done. They need those cleanups done in order to restore the economy of the state of New Hampshire that has stood faithfully by this charge of trying to provide protection against the Soviet Union.
Governor Brown?
Energy, efficiency, the economy, they all go together. The Japanese know this. That's why they're putting up massive sums in foreign countries and to develop the clean technologies for the future. We're not doing that at anywhere near the level we have to. The great scandal of this administration and in this era is that there are unemployed people who could be retrofitting buildings, rewiring and re-engineering motors, lighting, heating and cooling systems. This is not just a cosmetic change. There is a ball and chain around the whole American economy, and it's the wasteful energy that is protected by the lobbyists, the oil companies, the coal companies, the nuclear industry. We need to break that stranglehold and embark upon a national policy immediately. And I challenge the president to do that because he can put millions of unemployed people to work doing precisely that, and it could be paid for out of the savings that would be generated. The stakes are very high because we have to develop the clean technology or else we're going to see China and third world countries tripling their coal burning, and then all our efforts at clean air will be doomed. I support the Green Peace Initiative, which would allocate $15 billion from the present defense budget to renewables and energy efficiency. And I go way beyond that to make sure we've put to work the unemployed people of America in our number one priority, making a clean, efficient energy society that can compete with other countries.
So out of the five of you, only two of you disagree. Well, Senator, Bernie, you slammed the senator's stand on which fuel to use. You want to respond to it?
If I could, I would like to say that I would like to characterize my positions myself and not have others do it. I was endorsed by the environmental community in New Hampshire. They know my policies. They know my work on Alaska lands, my work on preserving Cape Cod, my work in setting up Thousand Friends of Massachusetts. But I will also say, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, that whatever differences we have here, compare us to George Bush. And people who care about the environment should take comfort that the alternative in November of this year, it's going to be an environmental policy they can have some faith in.
Yeah, I'd like to give up some of my time at the end just to say one thing that I heard.
Each of you, please jump right in.
All of us are saying something, and I think, I don't know if we're going to make any news tonight or not, but I think we just all said something that we ought to say together right now. Every one of us believes that the President of the United States should go to the Rio Conference and say the United States has been lagging on agreeing to global standards on global warming, and we are going to agree right now to agree with the Europeans on reducing CO2 emissions, increasing fuel efficiency standards, doing whatever we have to do to meet a common standard with the Europeans. They are getting, some of those countries are as rich or richer than we are. We can afford to do this. It will generate new jobs. And what I heard all saying is we at least want our president to do that. And I'd like for that clear message to come out of here tonight.
Is that an amen from
Arkansas
all of you or
Governor
what?
Bill Clinton.
Is that an eight?
That's what I said.
Yeah, we agree on a climate treaty. But let me make it clear as well, Bernie, that one of the things that I'm trying to do in this campaign is to say as president, I'm not going to blame our problems on the other guy. Very often, we are creating our own problems. I mean, we are rising on a pile of garbage in America. It is a pile of our own making. We are, as I indicated earlier, consuming 25% of the world's energy. Our behavior is going to have to change. And it isn't just, again, the Republicans doing this, although George Bush is massively indifferent to the exciting possibilities of energy efficiency, massively indifferent to the need to redirect our resources so as to support the American workers. I don't believe George Bush understands what a job means in America today.
Right. There's one other thing I think that we all agree on. And that is, it's not a trade-off between the environment or jobs. We all believe that by cleaning up the environment, by moving towards renewable energy sources, recyclable products, it's actually going to create jobs, just like I said Wes Birdsall did in Osage, Iowa. And what he did there, I want to do for America.
Well, you know, there is that issue of nuclear power, since we are here in New Hampshire, and there is something called Seabrook, and there's a gentleman named Steve Connolly who's about to go to jail because he's been keeping confidential, or at least will not answer, whether or not whistleblowers have given him evidence of counterfeit and substandard wells. Now, just to put you on the spot a little bit, Paul, I am told that his office is going to yours, ask for some help. And you told the people down at Keene that you were going to be the friend of the whistleblowers. Now, here you've got one in your own state of Massachusetts, and he's asking for help, and he's trying to go to bat to expose what appears to be some fraud down there at Seabrook. I think that's a pretty important issue.
If I could respond, first of all, when Seabrook was being built, one of the five of us said it was the wrong place. It wasn't you, it was me.
I opposed it way back 12 years ago.
Well, I opposed it too. So that don't draw that difference, okay? Number one.
Well, I think it is a difference, Paul. I think that, I mean, that we have a lot that we share, but on the nuclear power, even though you're saying it is a last option, we have 112 plants, and I would phase those out, all of them, over the next 10 years. What would you do about
and
that?
You would replace it with what?
I'd replace it, first of all, with the gigantic, obscene waste.
A shareholder lawsuit. So every utility now has it in their self-interest to be aggressive in bringing about conservation and renewables. That's how we're going to do it.
Why would it be better through the federal agencies and through Congress just to say that all of our electric utilities have to do what the best ones are doing today, starting in California, and engaging in least cost planning, that is, using conservation in the same calculation as you would use building a power plant? I mean, I think that's what you're advocating, and I think if we did that nationwide, you would find that we don't need a lot of new power plants in this country.
The reason why I believe California is the world leader in alternative energy is we stopped nuclear power. We fought it every step of the way, and the utilities themselves are now the biggest champions of efficiency and renewable energy because they have no other choice.
They found an alternative.
I also want to say that one of the things that I did when I was in the Congress was to introduce the bill and champion legislation to do away with QIP. Now, who knows what QIP is?
Construction work in progress.
And I just want the people of New Hampshire to know that's what Hugh Gallon fought so hard for when he was governor of this state, our beloved Hugh Gallon. And I was the one that took the lead in that. And unless we get rid of that QIP, they're going to keep right on building nuclear power plants.
Yeah, let me say on nuclear, too. I mean, Paul, we're not all trying to gang up on you. We're not saying you're wrong all of the time. But on this particular issue, I mean, I think you are. I mean, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has lied to the American people. The Department of Energy, when I was governor of the state of Nebraska, lied to me. They said when they were shipping high-level waste across the state that they were going to notify us. They didn't notify us. We had to fly a bunch of helicopters down and block them so they couldn't come across the state. When your own government lies, it causes the people to break trust and lose trust. And nuclear power, it seems to me, is fatally flawed because we have no capacity to get rid of the high-level waste. We're struggling, in fact, to get rid of the low-level waste. And we have tremendous and exciting opportunities in the area of energy efficiency to produce more energy through efficiency and cheaper energy through efficiency than we ever can through what I consider essentially to be socialized energy, and that's nuclear.
In fairness to you, Senator Tsongas, did you fully address to your satisfaction the charge that Governor Brown was making about someone being in your office?
I'm not sure whether, I believe that it happened, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't say to him personally, right. Brought representations to your office. He's a whistleblower, the NRC's after him, and Paul said that he would be a friend
to
of the whistleblowers,
that you have a chance to.
So I just wanted to invite him to be a friend of one in his own neighborhood.
I will do that, but let me make it very clear. My argument goes back a long time. Fact is, there's a finite amount of fossil fuels on this earth. If we take the position that we assure that we can do away with this energy source of nuclear power, we are going to end up with more fossil fuels. We just went through this rhythm of saying we're all aggressively pursuing the president on global warming. If you take out all your nuclear power plants, by definition, you're going to have more fossil fuel burning and add to the greenhouse effect. I take the position that the threat long term is global warming, and that threat is real. And that's where I'm coming from.
Well, I don't think you need nuclear to get rid of global warming, for gosh sakes. What Jerry Brown is talking about earlier is absolutely right. I don't know, $300 billion, but we could save $160 billion over the next 8 years just by tightening up corporate average fuel economies. Gosh, 12 miles per gallon. We're at 20 right now, and Ronald Reagan did a total dive on corporate average fuel economy. Another 12 miles per the gallon produces energy efficiency enough to require us not to import anything from the Persian Gulf. I mean, we've got a lot of energy that we can generate just through the avenue of savings. So I disagree with you, Paul, when you say that the choice is either nuclear or oil.
I'm not sure what my position is on building more nuclear power plants.
You have, the longer they run, the more probability that there's going to be a radioactive release that affects people.
I'd like to know what Governor Clinton's position is on building more nuclear power plants. We haven't heard that one yet.
My belief is that we have enormous electricity capacity now. I do not favor anything that will accelerate the building of nuclear power plants. I am against this one-stop permitting bill that's in the United States Congress. I don't know how everybody else feels about it. I think if you have least cost planning, if you have major incentives to the utilities to engage in conservation, if you have a major attempt to convert to natural gas wherever you can, and I realize that's in my part of the country, but now you can get natural gas in New England because of the pipelines, I don't think you're going to see a need for new nuclear power plants. And I certainly don't believe we should continue to do what happened in the Reagan-Bush years, where they pushed nuclear plants at sometimes 5 and 6 times cost overruns, and they shoved them down the throat of states like mine, which never even approved them.
Well, please, gentlemen, don't expend all your energies on energy, because we have more questions. 3 days from now, all of you will pack up and leave the great state of New Hampshire. What single economic promise you have made will find a job, buy a meal, or pay for a prescription medicine?
Bernie, I'll take that one right off the bat. I'm the one that's got an economic program, a specific 5-point economic program. I call it my blueprint for the future to rebuild America. There are cities and towns all over New Hampshire and indeed all over America. The Conference of Mayors pointed out over 4,000 ready to go, where they have plans on the shelves for city improvements. This could be streets, sewer and water, bridge replacement, school improvement programs. I just had dozens of local councilmen and mayors sign on to my campaign. They stood in back of me and announced for support for me, and they all held up blueprints of the plans that they have on the shelves right now in places like Franklin and Derry and Portsmouth and Nashua, up in Berlin, all over this state. My program calls for putting $35 billion over and above what we're doing right now, right down to these local communities next year. They'll be able to let those contracts out to the private sector, put people to work immediately all over this state and all over America. And guess what happens when those people go to work? They get well paid. They go downtown. They shop on Main Street. They buy clothes for the kids. They buy a carpet for the floor. They buy furniture for their house. They may even buy a new car, American, I hope, and gets the economy going again. That's the specific promise I've made, is to take that peace dividend. Next year, get that $35 billion down to these local communities. The first words out of my mouth next year, Bernie, after I take that oath of office, is going to be, America, start your engines. Time to go to work.
Well, these other four are going to have something to say about that, Senator. Let's see what they say.
Right. Well, I don't know where he's going to get $35 billion, but we'll come back to that later. I mean, the things that I would do immediately are to say to the banking regulators, you've got to start making loans. I'd get capital in the banking system, and I'd back it up by bringing small business administration credits to small businesses so that we can start creating jobs at the community level up. And secondly, I do believe that a targeted investment tax credit, particularly targeted for the manufacturing base, followed on by making sure that money is going into manufacturing base here in the state of New Hampshire, as well as other states, would produce tremendous increase in employment. I bet I haven't visited a single factory in this country yet in New Hampshire that doesn't have some urgent need to modernize. And if our workers are out there operating 20, 30, 40-year-old gear against other countries that are using 2, 3, 4-year-old gear, we're going to have a tough time competing, and our standard of living is going to go down. But let me also say, in defense of
Tom and everybody else on this platform that no one in America, no political figure in America, is more indifferent when it comes to jobs than George Bush. He is massively indifferent. He does not know what a job means to most Americans. Yeah. I said the other day, I heard that he, like Paul Tsongas, has called economic arms so much that he was going to put his own one out, called Farewell to Economic Arms, because that's exactly what's going on in this country. I mean, he is marking time. This recession started over a year ago. And now that it's a political issue, the president responds. And it's too late for an awful lot of people that have lost their jobs, lost their homes, and lost their confidence as a consequence.
Governor, Senator?
If I were president tomorrow, I would accelerate the highway funding of the next 5 years and compress it into 2 or 3 years. I would change the bank policies very specifically, and I would tell the federal regulators that have taken over New Hampshire banks that are now calling loans on businesses that have never missed a payment to stop it. I would establish, as a part of the Federal Bank Reform Act, a whole network of small business development banks throughout the country to make community-based small business loans again. This state can turn around in a hurry because they got well-skilled, well-educated people, if you had that. And I would have some changes in the tax law, which would give people incentives to invest in plant and equipment here. Not only an investment tax credit and some modification of the real estate laws, but I would remove the incentives that now exist in the tax code to shut your plant down here and move it overseas, and instead give incentives to invest in our economy.
Senator?
I think, Bob Kerry is right. George Bush and Dan Quayle, too, by the way, they have steel cable safety nets. So no matter what happens to this economy, they will not be hurt. We've seen that in New Hampshire. As president, you have to do first, day one, declare an economic emergency. Give the American people a sense of the peril that they face, and then begin to move in the direction of articulating an understandable economic battle plan. If you go into any community in New Hampshire, and you ask any person you meet on the street, what is the economic battle plan of George Bush to make the United States competitive? Nobody can answer that, because there is no such plan. This, thank you for the reference, Bob. This is mine. And I would urge anyone who would like a copy to get in touch with us. It's very simple. Where is the engine? The engine is manufacturing. What are the needs? Venture capital, equity capital, credit. That's how you grow the companies so they can expand, employ people, so people can have jobs and provide for their families.
Governor?
Just in reference to the cold arms, I believe each of the three major tax breaks put in there have already been tried and then removed, and now they're bringing them back again. So I make the proposal, let's get to a simple, fair, flat tax that will allow business to know what their burden is and plan out a long term. Also, it removes from those making middle and lower income a tremendous amount of the tax they're now paying. But let me say, if I am President of the United States, having been elected on a reform campaign of taking no more than $100, fighting the congressional pay raise, fighting for term limits at the Democratic Convention, we will already see a second American Revolution, and we'll be in position to do what all these people are talking about, and they sound so great. Why haven't they happened? And they haven't happened because there's something unreal about all this. The thing in Washington, the government, the way it works, is stuck. And when I say that we could save $300 billion every year in this country just by energy savings, and that we could put millions of unemployed people to work achieving that goal over the next 15 years, you have to say, why doesn't it happen? And it doesn't happen for one reason. The system is stuck, and only if New Hampshire sends a very powerful message that they want that system changed, will we have any hope of really dealing with many of the good ideas that we're hearing?
Let me just say one minute. It doesn't happen because of the president. It doesn't happen because we got a president who doesn't believe we need a national economic plan. That's why it doesn't happen. That's why you've had middle class people working harder for less money. A national network reported tonight that the average middle class family was working 1 month longer a year in 1989 than 20 years ago. We need a national plan, and then we need a commitment to taking care of one another again. I don't think you can just make this economic. There's far more than economics here. And we are trying to instill a sense of common purpose in this country again. That is something that this guy doesn't believe in. They have cynically manipulated the people in New Hampshire, and I don't know, we all agree with that, but I think it's very important to put that on the table. You got to have more than economics. You got to go beyond manipulation and level with people and pull them together.
First of all, Bernie, again, getting back to this issue of putting people to work, there's a lot of pain out there right now. I mean, people are out of work. They're losing their homes. Here in New Hampshire, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to. Talk to Marie and Bob Mulliken.
He lost his job in September. They're going to foreclose on his home and throw him out. I say that's wrong. We need a national moratorium, and I've called for that, on foreclosures of homes of people who've lost their jobs. Let's stretch them out. Let's keep them in their homes. Secondly, we've got to put people to work right away. Now, again, Paul says that the engine that moves our economy is manufacturing. I'm sorry. The engine that moves our economy is people, our human resources. Well-educated, healthy, well-motivated, from strong families in strong communities with good job opportunities. That's what drives our economy, our human resources. And lastly, I have to say this. This is sponsored by the League of Women Voters. We haven't even touched on the role of women in our society and in our workforce. And that is one of my five-point economic programs in my plan to rebuild America, is let's focus on the family.
Okay, you're not going to go over the 5 points now, are you?
Because, No. Right. I'm going to go over the one that deals with women.
All right.
Because half of our workforce are women, and they're still getting 69 cents on the dollar that a man's getting. And I say that's wrong. 72 years after women got the right to vote, it's time for pay equity. It's time for equal rights. It's time to have family leave programs, child care programs, to make sure that the women who are forced to go into the workplace today are able to still take care of their families.
Bernie, let me insert one thing in here. I mean, as a Democrat who's done deficit reduction, I was governor of Nebraska, entered with a deficit and left with a surplus. And, you know, one of the things that I'm arguing, and I'm going to make it clear to the people in New Hampshire, that if you want to get rid of this deficit, and we've got to, it's a moral obligation. I mean, I made a lot of money in my lifetime because my parents worked hard to build a paradise, but it wasn't for them, it was for me. They sacrificed for me. They put themselves on the line for me. And right now, we're doing just the opposite with this deficit financing. $4 trillion worth of debt and a $400 billion deficit this year. I mean, we've got to take concerted action. And the only way that you're going to be able to do that, Bernie, with great respect for a lot of my friends out there who are concerned about what I might do by taking the size of the federal government down, the only way you're going to do it is by demonstrating the capacity to say no to friends. It's a lot of fun to say no to enemies. I mean, I kind of enjoy that. But saying no to friends is precisely what we're going to have to do. And make no mistake about it, reducing the size of our deficit will increase economic opportunity for every child out there right now who's in fourth grade, who is going to be graduating into the year 2000 and is going to have significantly higher debt as a consequence.
The time crunch is breathing on us, but quickly to you, Governor Clinton, before...
No, maybe we could just all talk about what we do specifically rather than rhetorically to reduce the debt. Because I think Bob's right about that. I mean, this whole generation, I mean, Ronald Reagan and George Bush basically gave us the politics of nostalgia, and we had a heck of a good time at our children and our grandchildren's expense. Now we've got to do two things that seem contradictory: increase investment in the public sector and reduce the debt at the same time. You got to stop the bank failures. That's about 25% to 30% of it. You have to reduce dramatically the recession through the kinds of investments we're talking about. That's $100-150 billion. Then I think if you bring health care costs in line with inflation and you reorganize these federal departments through a quality management system, I mean dramatically restructure them, you can save another $100 billion over the next 4 years and spend less than you save. That plus defense reductions will enable us to both increase investment and reduce the deficit, and we owe that to our kids, both things.
Last question, brief answers please. In this presidential election, for the first time, more than half of nationwide voting could be done in the suburbs. But the cities are still there, many dying, some dead. What would you do to save urban America?
Well, Bernard, I live in a city not far from here, Lowell, Massachusetts, not unlike Nashua and not unlike Manchester. A city that was a great city, had its textile base, its manufacturing base, disappear. My father was a small businessman, and we lived through that. It was not very pretty. We came back because we had high technology, a new manufacturing base. That's why I care so much about it, because this, for me, is not theory. This is not some staff memo. I live this as a child. What I have to do, what we all have to do, is get this economy moving so you can have that kind of expansion, so people in the cities have jobs. And it is the private sector investing in the cities, which is the way you bring those cities back.
One way you can make the cities with the greatest unemployment come back is make an enterprise zone, and for 10 years, free the company of any taxes if it invests in that area and hires the people in that particular place. And if we do that and turn the welfare check into a welfare voucher that can be exchanged with a private employer, you'll see people going to work who are now not doing anything.
Bernie, I
last summer, I gave a speech in New York City about my plans for New York City. The same day, on the page of the front page of the New York Times, was Governor Cuomo's plan to rebuild New York City. Governor Cuomo's plan to help New York City is the same as my plan. What Mayor Ray Flynn of Boston is talking about to rebuild the cities is my plan. Cut defense spending by 50% over 10 years. That's going to free up $420 billion. I'm going to take $280 billion of that and put it into a fund to rebuild America, and it's going to go right directly into our cities.
Did you have to mention Governor Cuomo's name? Now more people will write his name in.
I mean, he's right, Bob.
If you do national health insurance, I hate to sound like a Johnny One Note, but the fact is national health insurance will bring $10 billion into the inner city because of underfunding right now with children. You provide continuous health care for all our children, eliminate the barrier of losing your health care if you move off of welfare. You can do the kind of welfare reform that Governor Clinton has been talking about, and nothing will help the inner city more.
We have to give the private sector incentives. We have to have a new community-based housing program. We have to do something about health services in the schools. And you've got to have an anti-crime program. More police on the street and community policing. More community-based boot camps to keep these kids from going to prison and to put them in contact with training and education and treatment again.
That concludes the second part of this debate. The third and final segment of tonight's agenda, closing statements by these candidates. Each candidate has been allotted 1 minute. The order of their speaking was determined by lot. We hear first from former California Governor Jerry Brown.
We have the resources in this country. We're a very rich nation. We don't have the commitment to every American family to make sure they have a living family wage. That has to be our number one job. This political system is stuck. It's stagnant. It's not working. If you have been touched by this message of grassroots organization, of living or dying on the shoulders of average voters, I want you to support this campaign. If you want to vote for a politics that has brought us where we are, there are other candidates that can provide that. New Hampshire, you are the messenger, and you can send a message to Washington that will wake them up and change the whole dynamic of this country. I love America, and I want to see that we really realize our potential. I want you to join this cause. You can. And you can do it by calling our number, 1-800-426-1112. That's the way, without knowing any politician, you can be a part of this cause. May God bless our undertakings.
Next, the governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton.
I'd like to thank this network and the League of Women Voters for providing this opportunity for us to talk to the American people. I'd like to say a special word of thanks to the people of New Hampshire for taking my wife and me and our campaign into your homes and your hearts, for sharing your pain, your frustration, your anger, your courage, your determination, and your hope. I've tried to offer specifics and solutions and a dramatically different approach to government. I believe this is a big, big election which will determine the life of America well into the 21st century. I believe we need a new, dramatically different economic course. I believe we need to come together in a new covenant to reestablish the bonds of community and decency and humanity, taking responsibility for each other. Any plan is a piece of paper. I've got more than a plan. 10 years and more of committed leadership every day trying to make today better than yesterday and tomorrow better than today. Embrace this challenge with me and we can change America and win again.
Next, former U.S. Senator Paul Tsongas of Massachusetts.
Thank you very much. Next Tuesday, America will be at a crossroads here in New Hampshire. There are two roads. One is easy, one is comfortable, but it's downhill. The other is the road to economic prosperity for a great America, a healthy America, a vibrant America. That road is steeper and it's harder, but it's more noble and it's more worthy. I believe on Tuesday you will choose that road. I think what you're saying to us is we are ready. Tell us the truth. Give us the economic truth. We can deal with it. We can prevail. We are a great nation. Treat us that way. George Bush has not. Tonight, I wish to take you in that direction as your president. It's going to be harder. It's going to test us. But at the end of it, when we climb up that hill, we will be on the mountaintop. And we can turn to our children and say to them, we have done right. This is a viable nation. We give it to you. We have lived up to our generational responsibility. That is the road that I wish to take. I ask you to come with me.
Next, a closing statement from Senator Bob Kerrey of Nebraska.
Thank you, Bernie. Now, 30 years ago when I graduated from high school, I had a tremendous economic opportunity, a lot of prosperity laying in front of me. And I had that opportunity because
Fortunately for myself and my seven brothers and sisters, we had two rather remarkable parents that worked their entire adult lives building a dream and building a paradise for seven sometimes ungrateful children. We have seen the dream of America wiped out by unchecked selfishness and greed of the 1980s led by Ronald Reagan and George Bush, who have told us that all we have to do is take look out for number one and everything will be okay. Well, I don't believe that. I believe unless we reinstitute the value of caring for others and caring particularly for our children, we'll not take the pathway to economic greatness. I will fight to put the people of New Hampshire and America back to work for national health insurance, to make our cities safe again, and most of all, I'm going to say to you that now is our time. Let's seize the moment and let's work to make America great again.
And finally, let's go to the Hawkeye State. We hear from Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa.
Thank you, Bernie. Tonight, I believe you good citizens of New Hampshire are asking for something back. Our government. A government that cares about you, that cares about your dreams, and cares about the kind of world that your children will inherit. Our campaign has drawn inspiration from the Presidents Roosevelt and President Truman and President Kennedy because their vision was a bold vision for the future, and so is ours. We mean to throw out Reagan-Bush economics completely, and we mean to return our government to our families and our communities, and to return something to government that's been missing for far too long, care and compassion in the White House. I do not believe that has gone out of style. If we do this, the future's ours. But if we lower our sights, and if we compromise with the forces of greed that dominate government in our society, then soon we'll lower our heads, we'll lower our hopes, then our children's hopes, and then freedom's hopes. We can never give up, not tonight, not ever. And I know you agree with me. And that's why I ask for your support on Tuesday. Together we can win the nomination. Together we can win the White House. Together we can build a new America. Thank you, God bless you, and good night.
And gentlemen, a return thanks to each of you. And that's it for this debate. Our thanks to these five major Democratic candidates who joined us here this evening. Thanks also to St. Anselm College for hosting tonight's event. Special thanks to the staff of Debates 92 for their assistance. For the co-sponsors of this debate, Cable News Network and the League of Women Voters Education Fund, I'm Bernard Shaw.